Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David Latulippe. This week I'll be talking with John Fisher and Donald Curry about their roles respectively as Benjamin Britten and W.H. Auden in The Habit of Art at Theatre Rhinoceros. Kevin Burke shares his directorial debut experience regarding Hamlet, currently at the Alcove Theatre. He'll be joined by Tim Gahan, the actor playing Prince Hamlet, and Rob Zimmerman, director of Beverly Hills Playhouse San Francisco. Plus Hope Moore, one of the Bay Area's best contemporary dance makers, will talk about her home season at ODC, joined by Henry Hung, who's providing some live improvised jazz music for these performances at ODC. The first Thursday of the month means Joshua Cosman stops by to offer his classical picks for the month of April. Stay with us. Classic Shakespeare in for you at the Alcove Theater, presented by Truepenny Players in association with the Beverly Hills Playhouse at the Alcove Theater on Mason Street, running through the end of April. Three of the creative forces involved in that production join me in studio today to talk about the production. Native San Franciscan and brother of KALW announcer Joe Burke, Kevin Burke is co-founder of Truepenny Players. He spent about 10 years in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and began performing in 2009. His last performance was of Leonato in Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing in 2012. This Hamlet is his directing debut. Welcome, Kevin.
Well, thank you, David. Glad to be here.
Tim Gahan is from Dublin, Ireland, originally. He emigrated to America 4 years ago to pursue and enhance his craft, which was honed in part at Ireland's most prestigious acting program at the Samuel Beckett Theatre in Trinity College, Dublin. Since arriving in the States, he has worked on several short films, and he co-directed, co-produced, and starred in Sam Shepard's True West as Austin at the Shelton Theatre last May. And he acted in the Baroque Theatre, Baroque Opera production of L'Incoronazione di Poppea with the West Edge Opera last year. He is a classically trained singer and fluent in French and Irish as well. Tim, welcome to our airwaves.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. Both Tim and Kevin regard the third member of this discussion group as a mentor. Robert Zimmerman is director of the Beverly Hills Playhouse San Francisco. As the beginning of that organization title indicates, Rob was first involved with the Beverly Hills Playhouse in 1991, where he has helped guide hundreds of actors in classes and workshops. He's been on the stage from Connecticut to San Diego with a healthy helping of some Hollywood film and TV credits thrown in as well, including The Larry Sanders Show and Twin Peaks. And welcome, Rob Zimmerman, to KLW.
Very good to be here. Thank you.
And you can now sneeze as well. We've gotten some sneezing and coughs from the rest of your cast, and feel free to just... There we go. Okay, Tim, get it out. That's good. So, Rob, I think I need you to first explain to us this designation from the title, presented by the Truepenny Players in association with the Beverly Hills Playhouse San Francisco. Who is what and why, and how did this collaboration get going?
Well, we took over the Alcove Theater in December, which was a real godsend for us because, as an organization, we'd been looking for a space to call our own. And as it happened, Kevin and Tim had already started working on Hamlet, and we knew that we wanted to get into production quickly. So we scheduled our debut performances of another play called Engagement, which closed a couple weeks ago. And because of the way Tim and Kevin were positioned, already being in rehearsal, already having cast, we decided to enter into a co-production with them and have them be our second show.
Great. And so Beverly Hills Playhouse San Francisco is kind of a new entity, and you're fostering that entity here in San Francisco?
Yes. I started teaching here about 4.5 years ago, and we've grown, thankfully, very steadily. And it was time to have our own space and start our own production schedules.
Kevin, you're making a debut as director for this version of Hamlet. Now, who have you worked with And who do you like to emulate as a director in your work as you move forward as a stage director?
Well, I've worked with, as an actor, I've worked with, let me just think, about five different directors, all of whom at the community theater level here in San Francisco. And I could and have and continue to learn a lot from each and every one of them in terms of the enormous amount of detail that goes into a stage production and its subsequent performance. I think that anyone who's ever done that can relate to we were just talking about out in the waiting room, in the green room, about the fact that we're all getting 3, 4, 5 hours of sleep a night and our body clocks are adjusting to that, given the workload. But the emulation, I think I get most of my ideas when I am directing, when I'm sitting there and the actors are on stage, I get most of my ideas from what I learned from Rob at the Playhouse. I was a student there for 2 years, and that got me to the point where I felt confident enough together with Tim to do something like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, likewise, the flip side of that coin, and you don't have to name names, who do you consider, what do you consider bad direction? And have you been a part of productions where it's been like, oh my gosh.
I think that, I don't know if I would say bad, but I think that the thing that's missing from a lot of productions that I've been involved with and those that I've been an audience member for is the acting itself. And it's clear that there's a lot of productions that are going on a regular basis in the Bay Area where I don't know what the director's background is or isn't, but it isn't actor-centric. So there's a lot of detail, consequently, that's missing as an audience member watching a play, especially Shakespeare. You really have to get in there and get into the nuts and bolts of what is Shakespeare saying? What's going on? You know, and how can that actor convey that to the audience clearly? And so I've been involved in a few productions where that wasn't happening, and that's frustrating as an actor.
So why Hamlet then? I mean, that's the big kahuna.
Well, it would have to be, because of this guy sitting here on my right, yeah. Tim. I think I telephoned him one day and said, I was doing Much Ado, and I got the idea, and I called him up and said, hey, you know, this is your time to do this. What do you think? And he said yes right away. And so that's how it all got started.
Mm-hmm. Tim Gahan, your experience when I first opened up the show indicated working at the Samuel Beckett Theater at Trinity College in Dublin. Who did you work with there that gave you some special insight into Shakespeare and in particular Hamlet?
Well, the course, as it were, the way it was framed, if you will, over the course of 3 years was very, you had to sign your life away essentially for 3 years, and you know, 9 to 5, and it was kind of conservatory training, and it was very good in the sense that it kind of disciplined you. And so I wouldn't say any one person, but because you kind of had a teacher for everything, singing and voice and dance and movement and, you know, acting. But at the end of the 3 years, I felt that the general pool of talent from that I got help from certainly gave me the confidence to come over here and emigrate, essentially, and give America a go. Uh-huh. A bigger industry is a bigger market.
Sure.
Because I didn't find Europe. I just didn't want to go to London or something. It's a little too easy, you know. A little, may as well get out of your comfort zone. So I wouldn't assign inspiration just down to certainly one person, but I just, after the call Kevin gave me about 8 months ago, I had to think about it for a night, because I had already started committing to a different production. We're going to go Waiting for Godot, Samuel Beckett. I just, so I had to kind of look at the two options, but I decided to go with Hamlet because it was, like Kevin said, it's the time to do it.
So what are you bringing yourself to the role of Hamlet? How have you interpreted it in the past, or how are great roles that you've seen? You're bringing your own spin to him, of course. but not with an Irish accent, I imagine.
No, I don't want to repeat myself and people don't understand me, so. Especially if it's Shakespeare. But I think just, you know, if you get the opportunity to do Hamlet and you're an actor and it's the right time to do it, you'd be a fool not to, and that's kind of been my main drive. The opportunity came about and I, you know, Godot can wait. It can go on hold for a little while, or as with any other thing, but you really need to select and pick your opportunities very carefully when they come by, you mm-hmm. know? So we knew, Kevin and I knew, that it was going to be Mount Everest to climb, and it has been. I mean, it's been ups and downs, and we've lost people, and other people have joined, and people have gotten sick, and people have gotten homeless, and jobless.
People have gotten fired.
Yes, and all sorts of issues, but the show must go on.
Drama within a drama, of course.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, when we think of Hamlet, we think, Shakespeare, and the familiar characters, of course, Polonius, Gertrude, Rosencrantz, and Guildenstern, and Yorick, and Ophelia. Laertes.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern will take a break from this play. I'll give you a little insight into our version.
Uh-huh,
they won't be showing up.
All right. But the story actually goes back much further in history,
That's
doesn't
right.
it?
What, yes, it does.
We think of this as, you know, a circa 1600 play of Shakespeare, and that he was the sole author. He had several versions of it.
Sure.
But
as of most Shakespeare's plays, they are his interpretations or his reevaluations of previous stories. I believe this early one was called... I should have my assistant director here because he's the Shakespeare dramaturg. But Hamnet, I believe it had an N in it, and it was called Ole Hamnet, something like that.
Exclamation mark, Ole
yeah,
Hamnet.
Yeah, yeah, maybe that's it was kind of like Ole Calcutta, only.
Exactly.
But I'm not the right person to ask for a lot of detail on that. But mm-hmm. you know, I do know it exists, and we've actually. Tim and I and my assistant director, Dan Mack, who's not with us today, have gone over some of that material and gleaned from it what's valuable and what's not valuable insofar as our interpretation.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about that interpretation. What do you bring? What are we going to see in this version of Hamlet that we will not have seen elsewhere?
Well, I don't want to let too much of the cat out of the bag, but...
I think we know what happens. So.
Yeah, you know what happens. We actually have... I'll throw you one idea. We have Gertrude seeing the ghost in the what's known as the Queen's Closet scene or the bedroom scene. And that's sometimes done, but not often done. I think John Barton did it in the 1960s to a lot of controversy. But it was a successful production. And we felt that the story tracks a lot better, especially at the end, if Hamlet's mother does see the ghost when he sees the ghost at that moment. So that's one. Tim, can you think of anything else that we've done unique?
Yeah, on a general overview level, trying to put on something like this, a production, and bring it to, especially Hamlet or anything Shakespearean, bringing it to a contemporary audience 450 years later is always going to be an immense task. But one has to do it, or the parties involved have to do it in such a way where it's relevant, it's fresh, the language is not aged or the expiry date is, you know, expired. And that's the main kind of challenge with material like this, you know, with writers like this, where you just have to make that extra effort to listen and tune in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And living, you know, in such a kind of fast-paced moving world these days, distraction everywhere, I mean, you know, go, go, go. It's a big ask to get people to pay $25 to come and see a show that's nearly, that originally runs at 4.5 hours without an intermission. So that kind of an ask for a contemporary audience, you really need to know what you're doing and have confidence in the way you're going to present a story. We've had about 4 drafts of the script. I mean, the original script that Shakespeare wrote, not the... whatever it was, Thomas Kidd, I believe the your Hamlet was based on the first in the folio and the first quarto and the bad quarto. But we, after a lot of time and effort, we chopped it down to 2.5 hours. And then we found out it was 3.5 hours and we were going like, oh God, this was only like a week or so ago and it's still evolving and de-evolving. But that's the challenge, but it's also...
We're at about 3 now.
Yeah, but that's part of the fun of it, because you know that you got to chop it. I mean, you have to. Generally, what we decided to go with, another little cut out of the bag, eliminating one or two of the characters and then assigning some of the lines to characters which have been taken out and then putting it towards others. But
yeah, our Polonius has become quite a complex and much more evil character, because all of the venom that Hamlet spews out towards Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is now completely concentrated towards Polonius. So we think it works pretty well.
Uh-huh. And one final detail I'll embellish was, instead of being, we've taken out the whole backdrop political kind of overview of the country as it was with Denmark and the rest of Europe at the time, war factions, and we're just keeping it strictly a family drama, just move the story along.
Yeah, Denmark's a prison, moving on.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that's Tim Gahoon, who stars as Hamlet in the Kevin Burke-directed production of Hamlet, presented by True Penny Players in association with the Beverly Hills Playhouse at the Alcove Theater. Kevin, so what are we going to see as far as the production goes on stage? Is it the contemporary setting?
Very contemporary, very... very abstract, insofar as we have a black box and minimal set, beautiful costumes designed and implemented by Maria Graham here in San Francisco, a local, very, very talented costume designer. And we've focused on the actors and the costumes, and we think that that's going to make this show very, not only visually interesting, but you know, with the actors, as we said before, conveying the message to the audience directly. So we've done away with all sets, and I mean, they'll be sitting on black cubes basically, so the costumes will pop.
Right, and tell us a little bit about the rest of your cast.
Well, let's see. Glenn Havlin will be playing Claudius, and he's actually the very first director I ever had in San Francisco. He used to be the director of the San Francisco Free Civic Theater, which was affiliated with San Francisco Unified... No, your Unified School District. He was with the DPW, and they had a theater program that did two or three free theater productions to the public every year. So he'll be playing Claudius, fine actor. In fact, when he auditioned for me a while back, I said to him, I never knew you were such a good actor. What were you ever doing directing? And we have Lynn Sotos playing Gertrude, also a veteran of Bay Area theater. We have Jenny Volley playing Ophelia. And this is something that I think Bay Area theater goers will enjoy, her performance of Ophelia is quite striking. It's quite unique, and she is a fine actress that I am very glad to be working with, and I've had to do very little in terms of directing. She's just kind of gotten up there and done it, and that's, in my short experience as a director, is a little unusual, so I'm looking forward to that. Who else do we have? We have Terry Kolke as Polonius, and he's a veteran, also a veteran Bay Area actor, who's doing a fine job. And let's see, Edwin Ortiz from the Beverly Hills Playhouse will be playing Laertes. And
Christopher Upham.
Christopher Upham is the player
he's
king.
He's Beverly Hills Playhouse as well. We have Santiago Morales, also Beverly Hills Playhouse. We also have another student called Eric Tippett, who's also playing. And Rick Allen, who's playing my best mate, Horatio.
And last but not least, Kathy Mello, who will be doubling as the player queen and the gravedigger.
Oh, fantastic.
And Dan Mack, who's playing the ghost.
Right. Wow, it's quite a cast.
It's a real mixed bag of cats, but it's nice.
It's nice to be hated by so many people.
So let's talk about your directing style. You mentioned Rob Zimmerman as being as an inspiration to a certain extent, Kevin. But I'm wondering what's your approach? Are you delving more into the text, more into the motivations behind the text, the between the lines, or is it all of the above?
I think it's all of the above. But my style, as it has turned out, is I tend to point to the emotional aspects of each character, and to highlight those things, and I think that especially in this play, This is a highly dysfunctional family, to say the least. And they all got some big problems, and their trajectories are not ones that any of us would want to be on. So I think that given those circumstances of what's on the page, I think the emotional trajectory, I guess, of each character is just so ripe and so rich and so unique within each character that I tend to sort of push towards that with the actors.
Mm-hmm. You know? So, co-founder of the True Penny Players, what's coming up after this?
Well, Tim and I have talked about a few options. I happen to be pulled in the Eugene O'Neill sort of direction, and I'm looking for the right actress to play play that lead. And it's if anyone knows that play, it's a very difficult physical role for a woman, and you have to find just the right person. And I think I already have the lead character opposite her.
He's talking about Moon for the Misbegotten.
Moon for the Misbegotten, okay. Right. Did I not say that?
No.
Okay. Yeah. No, I wasn't going to do Eugene O'Neill's complete life works, but no. Moon for the Misbegotten, you know. And then I've always wanted to do The Iceman Cometh, but coming on the heels of Hamlet, I think I might not be alive halfway through that production, so I think we'll wait on that for a while.
Uh-huh. And Rob Zimmerman, more collaboration with True Penny?
Well, this is a really exciting time for us in terms of experimentation, and this co-production is part of that experimental fervor that we're going through right now. Anytime you start a new production company of any kind, it's an act of madness. So we're finding out, you know, what parts are just kind of a little bit crazy and which parts should be taken out and shot behind the
bar. We're the crazy part.
So we'll see. We'll see. We're feeling our way. We're making mistakes. We're doing good stuff. And it's an exciting time for us, and we hope it's an exciting time for the audiences as well.
Well, I wish you happy trails ahead, Rob Zimmerman, with your work with the Beverly Hills Playhouse San Francisco. Tim Gahan, a wonderful run of Hamlet is coming your way, I know, through the end of April. And directorial debut, Kevin Burke, thanks for sharing some information about Hamlet. It's at the Alcove Theater on Mason Street, just close to Union Square. More information at True Penny Players. TruePennyHamlet.blogspot.com. We'll put this link directly on our website. And you can also go to eventbrite.com for some more information. Gentlemen, thanks so much for taking some time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, I'll be talking with John Fisher from The Habit of Art, along with Donald Curry, who is also starring in that production. Joshua Cosman offers his classical picks for the month of April, and a visit with dancer Hope Moore and trumpeter Kevin Hung just ahead here. Henry Hung, just a moment here on KLW. Stay with us on Open Air. Thank you. That's music of Henry Hung, which will be featured for the Hope More Dance Company's productions at ODC. Henry joins me here in studio along with Hope More. Hope is one of the Bay Area's leaders in postmodern dance, and this year the company, Hope More Dance, explores a program dedicated to experimentalism in choreographic form by its namesake founder. This season is their seventh and features three premieres, including Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction, a full company work set to a live jazz score. Performances are April 10th to the 13th at ODC. Hope founded her company after performing with a number of pioneers in modern dance, including Tricia Brown, Margaret Jenkins, who was my guest last week, Lucinda Childs, and Douglas Dunn. She trained at the San Francisco Ballet School and was introduced to modern dance at Stanford. In New York, she trained at the Merce Cunningham Dance Studio and the Tricia Brown Studio. Among her many company projects, in 2005, she also worked with Lucinda Childs in the premiere of Dr. Atomic for San Francisco Opera. She's an artist in residence at ODC Theater and is a 2014 participant in CHIME, which stands for Choreographers in Mentorship Exchange Across Borders. She writes regularly about choreographic process through her blog, The Body is the Brain, at HopeMore, HOPEMOHR.org. Hope, welcome to KLW.
Thanks so much.
Of course. She's joined by Henry Hung, who is the composer and lead musician for one of the works, Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction. Henry's a multi-instrumentalist, arranger, composer, and educator who trained at the Manhattan School of Music and SF State here in San Francisco. Very active on the Bay Area's jazz and dance music scenes. His style of composing doesn't quite fit into a neat box, as he's quite a broad range of interests in his musical background. He's been seen and heard all over the Bay Area map, including at SF Jazz, Outside Lands, Hardly Strictly Bluegrass, Stern Grove, and the Great American Music Hall, among many others. Henry, welcome to KLW.
Thank you.
Hope, so experimentation and improv involved in this is... What exactly is notated? But let's hold off on that. Now, is all of your work focused on that kind of freeness of improvisation?
No, not all of my work. It's an increasingly central interest of mine, but improvisation is a departure from what I've done in the past. In the past, most of my works have been entirely composed and fixed. So this interest in improvisation and in colliding improvised form with composed form is a relatively new interest of mine.
Mm-hmm. And this seventh season is at the ODC. Talk about this season, especially this new work that features live music.
Sure.
Jazz.
Our performance next weekend at ODC Theater features three pieces. Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction is one of those three pieces, and in that piece, I'm collaborating with Henry and all of his musicians.
Mm-hmm. Henry, who exactly is involved in this live jazz presentation with the dancers?
So on it's a quartet, and on drums is Patrick Cordy, who performs with largely this group called the Jazz Mafia Groups in the Bay Area. And there's a bass player named Tommy Follin, who's traveled internationally and performed with many different types of groups. He's a very highly in demand, wonderful musician, and Michael Coleman on keyboards, who is, I would say, one of the great figures of creative improvised music in the Bay Area right now. And it's just a pleasure to work with all of them. Mm-hmm. With Hope.
Well, Hope, the dancers must need some sort of underlying structure. So, how does that work with music that's being improvised?
Yeah, throughout the process, we've played with the balance of structure and freedom. I've played with a balance as a director between controlling and composing according to my aesthetic imperatives, and also balancing the importance of dancer agency and having the dancers be empowered to make decisions in real time. So the final performance is really a blend of improvised material and set material, and the whole rehearsal process has really been about finding the right cocktail of improvisation and composition.
So with that improvisation as a part of the performance, there'll be no two performances the same, but
there'll
still be a recognizable structure for beginning, middle, and end.
That's right. There are anchoring forms and rules that shape the dancers' decisions. Rules that have to do with their use of space or time, In some sections of the dance, they're sourcing given vocabulary. Some sections, they're not. But I have tried to craft the whole piece aesthetically so that it coheres, and so that I have a sense of authorship, while at the same time the dancers also have agency.
So if this is a work that's going to be different every night, how is it preserved? I mean, we have the modern technology of recording it, but are there notes also involved in the title Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction? First of all, we have to talk about that title. Well, let's talk about the title after we talk about the preservation. Like, if this were to be revisited in 5 years, would it be solely relying on the video preservation of it?
It would be a combination of the videography, and yes, I do have notes. Writing is actually an integral part of my choreographic process, so I do have extensive writings about the process. Each open score that the dancers work with has linguistic cues, and so it's a combination of language and video. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so do talk to me about the title of this work that's with Henry here, Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction. How did
Sure.
that title
It's come the from? Title of a Wallace Stevens poem. I'm a big poetry fan. I write poems myself. So I always find inspiration from poetry. And in that poem, Stevens sets forth his three rules for poetry, which are: it must be abstract, it must give pleasure, and it must change. I knew that this piece, in contrast to previous pieces, was not coming from a personal, emotional place. It was going to be more of an abstract aesthetic venture. And so those three imperatives struck me as appropriate for this project.
And some of your own poetry is involved in this production too.
That was an original intention, but the piece, there's so much going on sonically that it felt right to let language drop away.
Mm-hmm. And so is this the only work where Henry's music will be involved, this one work?
Yes. The other two pieces are not to live music.
Mm-hmm. So Henry, talk to me about how the music evolved. Is it a matter of reacting to the choreography, or you're in your own world and they're reacting to your music?
It's a combination of all of that, which is fantastic, which is what makes the piece so vital for me. We started, Hope and I, we started discussing the piece 6 months ago, about. Mm-hmm. And we used some previous material I've recorded with other groups as a launch pad. And we had certain ideas to play around with, using text, sound samples to kind of manipulate effects. But we really didn't. The first couple of rehearsals were really about improvising together and having the musicians react to the dancers, having the dancers go through their set rules and actually have the musicians kind of try to live in those kind of set rules as well and react to them. And from there, we've kind of formed slowly the structures that we play around. It's pretty vague, but it takes this long process to kind of find these pillars, and I think what we have is pretty interesting.
The musical progression, how the musicians are organizing their approach has really changed. Henry and I started off with a handful of set compositions, and so at first the musicians were score based. They were based in a musical score, but then they realized that did not give them enough freedom to be responsive to the dance. So then they switched to a dance-based score, and then that also felt too limiting. So then they switched to more freer improvisation, reacting in real time to the dancers. There's still some choreographic landmarks, but we've thrown away the musical score and thrown away the dance score, and now it's more just real-time improv.
Neat. You mentioned briefly the other works that are involved in this program. That's Hope Moore, by the way. Hope Moore Dance presents its 7th home season at ODC, the 10th to the 13th of this month. Hope, tell me a little bit about your company of dancers.
Sure. I started my company in 2007 after moving back to San Francisco from New York. The dancers I work with now, there are 6 of them in the jazz piece, although there are 9 performers total in the performance. The company of dancers, many of them I've worked with for several years. I like to have long-term creative relationships with them. They're true artistic collaborators. much in the lineage of how Margaret Jenkins works with her dancers. It's a very collaborative process. I work with people not only for their physical talent, but also for their intelligence, for their curiosity. So my creative process is not hierarchical. I don't come in and deliver from on high their orders. It's a very dialectic give and take in the studio. So they're all extremely intelligent. Many of them make their own work, and they're absolutely crucial in forming the end result.
Well, we look forward to seeing this particular work, especially the collaboration with Henry Hung for Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction, part of the Hope More Dance 7th season at ODC. Information at odcdance.org. You can also read more about Hope's creative process at hopemore.org. That's H-O-P-E-M-O-H-R. And for more information on what Henry's up to, visit henryhungmusic.com. Henry, Hope, thanks so much for taking some time
today.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Bit of music of Benjamin Britten, which figures into our next segment on The Habit of Art, a very British comedy by Alan Bennett. The Bay Area premiere happening at Theater Rhinoceros through the 13th of April. A couple of the creative talents involved with that production join me now in the studio. John Fisher is the actor and director in The Habit of Art. He plays Benjamin Britten. John is also a playwright and executive director of Theater Rhinoceros. His plays have been produced around the country and on HBO as part of the annual U.S. Comedy Arts Festival. He holds a PhD in dramatic art from UC Berkeley, where he also taught. He also taught at UC Santa Cruz, ACT, and Yale School of Drama. John was here recently in January to talk about his production of Sondheim's Roadshow, and it's a pleasure to welcome him back to our airwaves.
Hey, John. It's great to be back, David. Thanks for having us.
Third-generation San Franciscan Donald Curry has acted, directed, and written since forever, I think.
Forever.
In addition to other companies, he has performed in a number of Theater Rhino productions, including Sex Rev, Staircase, The Philanderer, Past Perfect, and Beautiful Child. Donald Curry portrays W.H. Auden in this production of The Habit of Art. Welcome to our studios, Donald.
Thank you very much.
John, when did you first encounter Alan Bennett's play?
I heard about it. My husband went to London and saw it, actually, at the National Theatre, and I've always been fascinated with it. I was, of course, interested in seeing what he was going to come up with after History Boys, a beautiful play, and I was thrilled to hear that he was writing a play about Benjamin Britten, who's always been one of my opera heroes, and Auden, who I knew, but fortunately have been able to immerse myself in for this project. So I've known about it for about 5 years.
There are multiple layers to this play, plays within plays, and quite a bit going on there. I'm wondering if you could first give us a quick synopsis of The Habit of Art.
It's about the relationship between W.H. Auden and Benjamin Britten, who knew each other. They worked together in the 30s. And stayed in touch with each other throughout their lives. And this is a speculation about whether or not what would have happened if they had collaborated on Benjamin Britten's final opera, an adaptation of Thomas Mann's Death in Venice. And within that is also a story of an afternoon they spend with a prostitute. So it's very interesting. They're at Oxford spending the afternoon with a prostitute. The framing for it, of course, is a rehearsal of this play. And I think Alan Bennett brings into that aspect of the play a lot of his trials and tribulations putting on theater. And that's, I think, for those of us who are actors, the funnest part about the show is the rehearsal process.
Mm-hmm. Donald, you share with us some of that fun rehearsal process?
What's really fun is bouncing back and forth between the rehearsal and the play itself. For myself, I play a character named Fitz, who is kind of the lead guy, and he's a pretty demanding star, but he can't learn his lines. And then I bounce back and forth between being him and then being W.H. Auden, and they're extremely different characters. And that's what makes the evening fun.
Mm-hmm. I understand there's also a sousaphone that becomes a part of the...
a sousaphone in drag.
Yes. How does that work in the production?
Well, also on stage is the man who wrote the biographies of both men, Humphrey Carpenter. And Alan Bennett did his research and found out that Humphrey Carpenter wasn't just a biographer of note, but he was also a amateur drag artist who played the tuba. So we decided to go one better on this production and get him a sousaphone because that wraps suggestively around the body. We thought it was both more sexual and more silly. So we hope Alan Bennett isn't offended that it's not a tuba, it's a sousaphone.
And goes well with his last name as well.
That's right, Craig Souza.
Craig Souza.
And honestly, the audience literally falls back in their seats when he starts blowing on that sousaphone.
It's loud in the theater.
It is loud.
It is very loud.
So did you guys have to do your own research into Britton and Auden? You must
Sure.
be familiar with them as historical figures.
Sure.
But how much did the play provide that you added to?
Well, I think both of us did a lot of work. I got a two-volume work about Auden's work, and I've always loved Auden. I have a lot of his poetry at home, so I was pretty familiar with his stuff, but I wasn't enough familiar with the stories of his life, so I did a lot of work on that. I have all of Benjamin Britten's operas on CDs and have seen a lot. And in fact, I'm going to Berlin after this show, and I'm going to see Billy Budd in Berlin. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And how about you, John?
Well, I'm still on my Benjamin Britten thing. Just riding my bike over here, I was listening to Owen Wingrave.
Oh.
One of his not as famous operas, but famous, I think, because it was the first opera ever written for television. And it's fascinating. And Britten could do that whole Alban Berg, Schoenberg thing of writing very odd modern music, but he could also do the very tuneful thing of writing beautifully tuneful operas like Peter Grimes and Midsummer Night's Dream. So it's been a really great journey for me to just immerse myself in all the operas and see that he had many, many voices and always challenged himself in exciting ways. I think that's so important as an artist.
And I think Auden did the same thing as a poet. I think that both of these men challenged themselves to stretch what they were capable of.
And they were naughty. They were just
very
naughty. They could write naughty,
naughty
things that you shouldn't write.
Very explicit. Mm-hmm.
Very explicit and full of all sorts of weird undercurrents. The play is a lot about that, about Britten's sexuality and what his music tells us, if you really listen, about him and what he liked.
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Britten figures prominently in my life as well. The War Requiem is our song. I met my partner 26 years ago at the production of a performance of the Britten War Requiem at Avery Fisher Hall.
Oh, wow. It's so beautiful.
What an amazing piece.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful.
Good stuff.
That's so romantic, the War Requiem.
That is really quite romantic. Yes.
Well, this was a time in England, too, where, you know, homosexuality, very prominent gentleman, Benjamin Britten, W.H. Auden, yet not exactly accepted by the mainstream society either.
Yeah.
So it's their creative output is pretty amazing with what they did.
Yeah,
circumstances.
And how in that very British way they were accepted while not being accepted.
Mm.
Like everybody knew, and it was fine so long as nobody said it.
Right.
And they lived very open lives, Benjamin Britten with Peter Pears and W.H. Auden with Chester Coleman, who were their collaborators. Everybody knew, but they didn't.
It was don't ask, don't tell.
Don't shove it down our throats.
But that's part of what goes on between him and me in the play is talking about that, where Auden is trying to push Britten to say, come on out. Go ahead and do it.
You can change
and
lives.
And Britten is all very buttoned up and saying, no, I can't possibly do that.
Yeah. So, what will the Queen think?
Yeah, what will the Queen think about the Queen?
Yeah.
Well, the fascinating layers that unwind in this play. I encourage folks to catch it if they can. It's at Theatre Rhinoceros, The Habit of Art, a very British comedy by Alan Bennett, directed by John Fisher and starring John Fisher as Benjamin Britten, Donald Curry as among others, W.H. Auden in the production. John has multiple roles as well. The show runs through the 13th at Z Below Theater, 470 Florida Street. Information at therhino.org. Gentlemen, I wish you a fantastic run, and thanks for taking a little bit of time to talk about it today.
Thank you very
thanks
much.
Thanks a lot, David.
Thanks, David.
The beginning of yet another month, the month of April, and a first Thursday feature on Open Air is a discussion with Joshua Cosman, critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, on what's coming up for the month of April on his calendar. Hi, Joshua.
Hello, David. Thanks for having me back. April is going to be a terrific month, and in particular, it's going to be a terrific long weekend towards the end of the month. The weekend of the 25th through the 28th, or the 24th through the 28th, is going to be so packed with musical events that some of us are going to have spinning heads. So let's jump right in. The high point of this month, and probably the entire season in my book, is the world premiere of Mark Morris's new staging of Handel's opera Acis and Galatea. This is a pastoral romp with shepherds and nymphs in love. And in this new staging, Mark is going to be using the Mozart version of the Handel score. Mozart sort of updated it for his period with added clarinets and lots of lush new orchestral fillips that aren't in the original, making it, as Morris said in the announcement, even cooler, even more beautiful.
Cooler than Handel.
Cooler than, yes, Handel to the max. His imagination for Baroque opera, I think, is just unmatched. Local audiences will remember his productions of King Arthur with music by Purcell and Platée by Rameau, all of which played here at various times in Berkeley. This is going to be the world premiere with his longtime collaborators, the set designer Adrian Lobel, costume designer Isaac Mizrahi. The Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra will be in the pit, if there is a pit. Nicholas McGeegan conducting, and so I think it will be a riot of inventive music and staging.
Fantastic, and kudos to Mark Morris. Always uses a live ensemble.
Exactly. Yeah, part of the requirements for working with him.
Well, I should mention also, while we're on Mark Morris, that his work Maelstrom is being reprised by the San Francisco Ballet this month, as well as in rotation. He's setting a Beethoven's Trio in D major, the Ghost Trio, and the choreography is called Maelstrom. It's on a program that also includes Yuri Posikov's staging of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. So that's quite an evening of ballet that I know that you don't bother with. But
That's not a way to put it. I look on it longingly from afar. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Well, I'm going to put in one more plug, too, because the ballet also has a Shostakovich trilogy, which has some wonderful music of Shostakovich, that parts of the Ninth Symphony, the Chamber Symphony, and the First Piano Concerto. So interesting to see that. And as you know, it's a crackerjack ensemble performing for the ballet.
Yes, it is. I'll try and make time to get over there and see that. Acis and Galatea was April 25th to 27th, as I just wanted to put that in there.
And more information for that Zellerbach Hall performance at calperformances.org and for the ballet at sfballet.org. Let's just hear a little bit of the Mozart Handel version of Acis and Galatea. Here's Bernd Turfel singing.
Sweeter than the berry, oh, redder than the cherry, oh, sweeter than the berry, oh, nymph more bright than moonshine night, like Kipling's Blind and Merry. Oh, nymph more bright than moonshine night, like Kipling's Blind and Merry, like Kipling's Blind and Merry, like Kipling's Blind and Merry, oh, redder than the cherry, oh, sweeter than the berry. Oh, redder than the cherry, oh, sweeter than the berry. Oh, redder than the cherry, oh, sweeter than the berry. Oh, nymph more bright than moonshine light, than Kipling's Blind and Merry. Thank you. bright as the melting cluster. No lily has such luster, yet hard to tame as raging flame and fierce as storms and bluster. Yet hard to tame as raging flame and fierce as storms and bluster. Yet hard to tame as raging flame and fierce as storms.
Just a touch of Acis and Galatea as interpreted by Mozart, the music of Handel.
And also that weekend, if you want something a little more recent, the Ensemble Parallel, this great new operatic organization, is doing a double bill of one-act operas by Poulenc. That'll be The Breasts of Tiresias and Kurt Weill, the Mahagoni Zongspiel. This is a strange and fascinating confluence of two rather disparate pieces. Brian Stauffenbiel, the director, is promising a production in which one of them will be a performance within a performance. I'm not sure yet how that goes together, but I'm looking forward to finding out. Nicole Paimon, who is the director of the organization, will be conducting, and the San Francisco Girls Chorus will be taking part as well.
Always does a spectacular job, really.
Yeah. And that's also April 25th through 27th at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco. The website is Opera Parallel, all one word and spelled in the French style, opera, PARALLELE.org. If those are not the one-act operas you're looking for, then you can head over to Walnut Creek that same weekend, where the Festival Opera, which is doing a yeomanly job of sort of pulling out of some organizational and financial crunch, and I at least am rooting very hard for that company to come back, because they've been a really crucial and important part of the East Bay musical landscape. They're going to do two performances of a double bill of one-act operas, The Emperor of Atlantis, by Victor Ullmann. This is a piece that was written and premiered in the Theresienstadt labor camp, death camp, not a death camp, excuse me. The concentration camp was sort of a way station to Auschwitz and other death camps. They're going to do that in connection with a newish piece by composer Jake Heggie and the librettist Gene Shear called Another Sunrise. This is a piece that they premiered in 2012 in Seattle for a program by the group Music of Remembrance. It's sort of Holocaust-themed art. And it's a piece about a Polish resistance fighter and Holocaust survivor who is telling her story to an interviewer as she tries to get through a sleepless night. So that'll be performed the 26th and the 28th of April at Mount Diablo Unitarian Universalist Church in Walnut Creek, and the website there is festivalopera.org. Also that last weekend in April, for those who aren't big opera aficionados, the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players is going to present a very interesting and ambitious four-day festival of electroacoustic new music called Sweet Thunder. They've got a sort of a who's who of new music groups coming to town, including ICE, the International Contemporary Ensemble, the Jack Quartet, which is this very exciting young New York-based string quartet. I believe that's the first time they're here in the Bay Area. Redfish Bluefish, which is the percussion group that Steve Schick runs in San Diego. The composer Morton Sabotnik will be on hand, and it's 4 days of exciting, new, and interesting music by Steve Reich, Stockhausen, Nono, and younger composers, including Anna Torvaldsdottir, Natasha Diels, and many more. So that's unfolding over 4 days at Fort Mason Center, April 24th to the 27th. And information about that is at their website, www.sfcmp.org.
Lots of new music this month as well.
Yeah. Also new music earlier, the Switchboard Festival, which is the terrific sort of mini marathon of new music that happens annually at the Brava Theater in the Mission at 2781 24th Street. This year we've got 10 hours of music. Excuse me, my math is screwy. It's 8 hours of music, 2 to 10 p.m. on the 12th of April. An array of local performers, including Gamelon X, Splinter Reeds, the pianist Kate Campbell, Soda String Orchestra, mostly young performers, and finally, to finish up, one final hour with the Kronos Quartet.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And information on that is at switchboardmusic.com.
Kronos is also getting around in some other ways this month than earlier.
Exactly. Kronos will be appearing this weekend in Berkeley at Cal Performances, part of the Cal Performances season-long observation of the World War I centennial in 1914. And they will be performing a new multimedia work called Beyond Zero, 1914 to 1918. This has music by Alexander Frebeloff and film by Bill Morrison. And the Kronos Quartet will be performing. That's this Sunday, the 6th, at 7 p.m. in Hertz Hall.
Cal, once again, calperformances.org for more information on that. And speaking of contemporary music, I do need to put in a plug for the Paul Drescher Ensemble, who Paul was a guest on Sarah's show, Revolutions Per Minute, this past Sunday, just played some really spectacular music. Among his guests for the program called Memory Gain, Paul Drescher Ensemble Electroacoustic Band. Amy X. Newberg's going to be his guest for that. Paul Hansen on bassoon, and some really interesting music. Sarah played by Conrad Cummings.
Huh.
It should be a really good concert. Also at the end of the month, or mid-month, at least the 18th and 19th of April at ODC Theater. So odctheater.org for that, or Paul's ensemble website, DrescherEnsemble.org.
And just to wind up, I want to plug for this weekend. Actually, it opened last night, Wednesday night, in Stanford, but the Philharmonia Baroque, again, with Nicholas McGeegan conducting, is doing their big dramatic blowout of the season, a piece called Judith the Triumphans, Judith Triumphant by Vivaldi. It's his only surviving oratorio. It's a big dramatic oratorio based on the biblical story of Judith and Holofernes, which you know involves a severed head. So that's always an audience draw. And they're going to do that this weekend, Friday night at SF Jazz here in San Francisco, and then Saturday and Sunday at First Congregational Church in Berkeley. And that will feature many of the singers that have been returning to Philharmonia Baroque over the years, including Dominique Labelle, Vivica Jeannot, and Diana Moore, and Cecile Van de Zandt. So a little bit of an alternate to their usual Handel festivities, but we'll have Handel, as we said at the beginning of the segment, we'll have Handel in the hands of Mark Morris. So that will compensate.
Exactly. Well, a month of April is coming in quietly, but boy, it's going you're going to need some caffeine by the time you're going to get through the month.
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, thanks for sharing your picks, and there's some great stuff to hear.
Good. Thanks, David.
That's Open Air for this week. I'm David LaTulipe. Open Air is produced by myself and Neil Swinkles. Our shows are archived at our website, kalw.org. You can send us some show ideas, and if you've got someone you'd like to have featured here in the performing arts scene in the Bay Area, send us an email. My direct email, david@kalw.org. Thanks for being with us.